Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Ahmed Paul Keeler recounts his fascinating life journey, from an idyllic childhood in Windsor to navigating trauma in English boarding schools, embracing modern art and theatre, and ultimately to finding solace in Islam. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, enjoy discovering the ideas and experiences that informed Keeler's book, Rethinking Islam and the West.
My name is Mohammed Jalal, and I'm really honoured to be presenting today's conversation, really, with Sidi Ahmed Paul Keeler. Now, Sheikh Ahmed has asked me not to give him a very long introduction. And I would like, however, to say that I first came across Sheikh Ahmed around 8 months ago, 7 or 8 months ago, when I listened to and watched a video that he had put together on YouTube. And I was compelled, really, to give him a ring as soon as I watched that video. And, you know, gracefully, I mean, amazingly, he responded back to me within a few minutes. And I was just taken aback by the generosity of that he gave me in terms of his time and knowledge since then. And I think I've interviewed you now twice for my podcast, A Thinking Muslim, and also we've been to two events across London, one in South London and one in East London. And every time, you know, we have met, the conversations we've had, what comes through is just how much time Sheikh Ahmed is willing to give to everyone. At our last event, there was a scout group, I think, that came along, a group of young boys, probably under the age of 11, I would imagine. And after the event, they all came to the front to speak to Sheikh Ahmed, and he was willing to spend many a time. I think if we had the time, he would have spent hours with them, just giving advice to these young men. And I think, and I believe, that conversation would have impacted each and every single one of their lives. And I can imagine, inshallah ta'ala, if Allah gives them life, in 50, 60 years' time, they would remember the wisdom that our Sheikh gave to them, such as, I think, the generosity of Sheikh Ahmed. So my apologies, I have given you a slightly longer introduction than you had requested from me. Today, we're going to be looking at one particular book, A Life's Journey, The Story Behind the Book by Sheikh Ahmed Paul Keeler. It's really a biography. It's a book discussing discussing why Ahmed has come to a particular worldview, has formulated concepts about the world around him. And it's a fascinating read. And you know, in many ways, this book should be read by, as I said previously, younger Muslims in particular, because it charts a life of a person who's been through a number of phases and has come to a view about the world around him, which I think all of us need to appreciate. And we're going to try to explore some of these ideas today and some of the thoughts that Sheikh Ahmed raises in his book. The conversation will follow the following format. I'm going to engage with Sheikh Ahmed about his story, about this book on stage. So we're going to have a to and fro, a Q&A. And then I'm going to open it up to audience participation. And you're welcome to raise as many questions as you want to my guest today. But I'm going to start, Sheikh Ahmed, with a very basic question. And it's a question about motivation. What led you to write this book, your biography? Because I notice there was a hesitancy at the very beginning to put a biography together. So what led you to this?
Thank you very much for those kind words. But I have to say that I felt I was contacting a big star. It's been, for me, a very wonderful few months engaging with you, because I find that there are some people who when one talks to them, everything flows. And there are other people, when you talk to them, you clam up and you don't say a word. He's one of the ones who makes me flow. I mean, I find myself very much engaged with the ideas because he's so fertile in his interests and in his knowledge. Now, my writing career began at the age of 70. And it was the actual business of this first book that I was really having problems with the idea of writing it, as I talk about in this book. But once I got into it, and once I found a way, then I started to really enjoy it, because it was like my whole life had been engaged with remarkable people and with remarkable projects. And I'd lived through a remarkable period. And I'd lived within that period in very powerful worlds, if you like. And it was as though when I came to the age of 70 and I had nothing to do, I was completely redundant, that the dear friends said, you must write a book, which is what they probably always say to anybody who's lived to a certain age. So it was then that I started taking it seriously, and I got down to the business of writing. And it was as though I had all the pieces of a puzzle through my life, and I was able to put that puzzle together. So it was basically putting the puzzle together. This is the end of a puzzle, which has been produced by the most remarkable people, the most remarkable contacts that I've been privileged to know. And when this book came out, and I'd been invited to become a visiting fellow at the Center of Islamic Studies in Cambridge, which is also something that people do when you're very old, you know. You can't make any trouble, they think. And they invite you to be a visiting fellow. There's no remuneration, it's just a sort of honorary thing. But it was wonderful because I had complete access to the whole university. And there are several people around here who I met during that period and was able to engage with. So it was wonderful. And that's when I wrote the book. And there was a remarkable scholar called Khalid Fahmy, Professor Khalid Fahmy, who was the director of the Center of Islamic Studies. And when he chaired the meeting for the launching of my little book, he was very, very kind and generous. And he said, this is not your normal academic work, which is produced by going to archives and reading hundreds of books. He said, this is the result of a life's journey. And we started the process of actually launching the book. And we went on some, you know, visits. We went to Glasgow, had a wonderful time in Glasgow. We went to Liverpool, etc. And I was being led around by Wasim, who I don't think is here. Well, why is he not here? Where's Wasim? Wasim should be here. Anyway, led by Wasim. And then COVID hit. And I'd had one person, and I don't know whether he's here. Is Stone here? No, he's not here. Stone is not here. I had one quite nasty little remark. I've made it up with him since, don't worry about it. But I had one another nasty remark where this fellow said on the, there was a Facebook at the time, and he said, I was thinking of buying this book, but when I saw it had no footnotes and no bibliography, I wasn't interested. So I thought, right, okay then. Well, give you your footnotes. Your biography, because the important thing about this book, which I wrote during COVID, and by the way, I have to say it was the most painful thing I've had to go through for a very long time, because I don't like looking back. I really don't like looking back. But I've discovered that I have an extraordinary memory for things when I put my mind to it. And I had to literally relive my life to write this book. And so I had to go through, halfway through this book, I had a complete breakdown. And I had to go through all of that again. It was an incredible experience. But what this book was, and what I was very careful about, is not an autobiography. It's a life's journey, is the story behind a book. This is not a personal biography. You're not going to find out very much about me as a person. It's very private. My sister's here, so she knows all about this. And my son. But this is a book about how the ideas came about, the people I met, where I got the understanding, where the pieces of the puzzle were produced which then came together in this book. So that's basically the story. It's a story of, as it says, as a life's journey, the story behind a book.
Fantastic. So let's piece together your life and how you formed these ideas that you've come to, that you've laid out in this book. So the book that Sheikh Ahmed was referring to is this piece of this work, Rethinking Islam in the West, A New Narrative for the Age of Crisis. Now, the way I understand your life, you it seems to me that you divide up your life into three distinct phases. I think that's, I think I'm correct in saying that. Take us through these phases, please, and on a macro level, on a general level, and maybe we can then specify and look at some of the specifics.
The first 18 years of my life, my home was Windsor. And you could say that Windsor was the center of the British Empire. It was the most, I think, conservative place in the United Kingdom. And I was born into a family which was, my father was a very, very successful inventor and businessman who created a business of optics. And his father had come from America, which is very unusual. So it was a new family in terms of moderate wealth, but the wealth was all in the business. But we had a wonderful home. We had a beautiful house. We had a wonderful gardens, and through to where the stables had been was a factory where there were several hundred people making instruments. And that childhood was a very happy childhood. There were five siblings, and the eldest of our family was my sister, who's just coming to her 90th year and is still running the whole show. She's in charge of our extended family, which goes to at least 100 people now. She knows them all. I don't. Less than a quarter of them, I think. Anyway, so it was a very, very strong family and a very, what I would say, normal childhood, until at the age of 8, we went to prep school, to boarding school. Being amongst the 2.5% of the population that was being educated for empire, to run an empire. And that education, which I went through for 10 years at boarding school, had not changed for 100 years. After the war, I went to school in 1950, so after the war, it was the same curriculum, it was the same mindset. So I was educated in empire. All my heroes were Sir Walter Raleigh, who put his cloak down for Queen Elizabeth II, Queen Elizabeth I, so she wouldn't get her feet wet, and Drake, who when he was the Armada was spotted, he was said, "Let's finish the game of bowls, and then we'll go and deal with the Armada," and the wolf climbing up the mountain to surprise the French, taking a whole army up where they find it impossible, and so on. So Alfred and the cakes, and you know, this sense of the heroism of the British, and that amazing statement of Macaulay that the British are the finest and the greatest people that the world has ever seen. We believed in it. I believed in it. I had this very powerful sense of the supremacy, but the generosity of the British. We were generous. We were kind. We were fair, but we were right up there. And my goodness, what a descent it was when you went across to France. Very smelly place, France. Anyway, so this was a childhood. But then, of course, I left school in 1960. And in 1960, everything had changed. Because first of all, I and my type were out of a job because the empire was finished. It was all being dismantled. And the great cultural revolution came. The reaction of the intellectuals, the reaction against empire, the huge, you know, which was taking place in France with Sartre and everything, was taking place in, you know, and it just so happened that the only thing that I was really interested in at school was drama. We had a wonderful drama department at my public school, and I got really involved in that. I loved it. So I was quite useless at academics and everything else, so they decided finally that I could go and study drama. But the drama school that I went to was the hotbed of the new drama. Look Back in Anger had just taken place. You know, Osborne, John Osborne, Pinter, all these people who were tearing down the world that I'd grown up in. And I spent 3 years with the kitchen sink, with the whole thing, you know, the world of angst, the world of literally destroying the church, destroying everything. My interest in drama sort of faded. And then I spent about 4 or 5 years with modern art, deeply engaged in modern art, becoming hugely involved in it. And then at the end of the 60s, everything went. And I became a part of a group called the Exploding Galaxy, which was doing just that. It was just exploding everything in terms of culture. And it was basically totally disenchanted by our modern world.
Was it a political movement you were involved in?
No, I was artistic.
Cultural.
It was artistic all the way through. It was a theatre, it was the arts. And then it was a group which was a sort of multicultural, multi-arts. You know, we were doing happenings on buses and in parks and in the thing. You know, incredible events which we understood somehow, but people looking on couldn't understand what the hell was going on. I mean, it was completely strange and weird. And it was at that moment when the miracle happened and I encountered Islam. And I suppose you could say that from then, that was when I was 28, my whole life has been a journey into Islam, which continues. I mean, you know, it never comes to an end, but it's a journey into Islam. And it was a beautiful, amazing journey because I had a wonderful introduction. And I was already a sort of organizer. I'd organized the gallery and I'd been the organizer with this Exploding Galaxy. And then my sort of vision of this incredible world of Islam resulted in my organizing the World of Islam Festival. It was my way of kind of communicating this, the beauty of the thing. So I really spent my whole life just being in a state of wonder at the extraordinary nature of the world of Islam. But and so these are the three periods, which couldn't be, you know, and it was incredible becoming a Muslim because, of course, as somebody who was brought up and was a very very much engaged with the church and a very beautiful church, it was like a return home because all the moral values returned, and then one had this complete change of perspective, which meant that I then watched amazed as the revolution of the 60s. This destruction of everything in the 60s, gradually, year by year, became the establishment, has conquered the establishment. So now I look with amazement because the 60s is now with us, but it's institutionalized and it is the establishment. The ideas of Sartre, the ideas of that, I forget her name now, she's in California or something. What?
De Beauvoir.
Oh, that's another, yeah, that's the one, yeah. But anyway, all these ideas, these were the ideas of the 60s. And Foucault here, Foucault there, Foucault everywhere. You know, he was one of the great figures of the 60s. So these have all become the establishment. That is the ethic of the modern. And to watch that happening, having been inside it, is very, very enlightening. You can understand it. So I was saved. If Islam hadn't come along and I had nothing to do with it, I wasn't looking for anything. I wasn't looking for anything. It happened. And that's what I found. You know, I'm a very lazy man. I've never actually looked for anything in that sense. It's all happened to me. Isn't it true? Am I right?
Can I ask you about that period in the 1960s when you, as you said in your own words, you embraced this destructive movement? And then after that, towards the end of the 60s, early 70s, you embrace Islam and you began this journey into Islam. How much did that countercultural movement help you to transition away from this mentality, this empire mentality that you grew up with? Like, in many ways, do you feel that interregnum, that period in between, was just destructive, or did it help you to deconstruct your ideas about empire and your ideas about Britain and about the values of the West in versus the East?
Well, this is very, very important because what happened in the 60s was that it was a huge teaching, the like of which we are now experiencing over Palestine. Suddenly, the whole focus And of course, the 60s ended with the Vietnam War, which was very important in America. But here its repercussions were different. But but right from the very beginning, it was a rediscovery, incredible rediscovery, incredible teaching which went on. Because the first thing that happened, I remember, 1962, an amazing film, The Battle for Algiers. Algeria, the French had been defeated in 1960. They had to leave Algeria after 150 years of horrific, horrific colonization. A million French had to leave Algeria. A million settlers had to leave. And this book, this film came out, which was made by the Italians. And for the first time, we saw the Arabs as human beings. And we saw the French as the monsters they were. Because they were monsters. The arrogance, the cruelty was beyond imagining. So this was one of the great educations. Suddenly you start to see the world. You know, India. We were especially in the hippie, the whole period, the latter part of the 60s, was a real discovery of India. Because India, I was taught, was the white man's burden. The only thing I knew about India from my schooling was the black hole of Calcutta. I don't suppose anybody knows anything about that now. You, Mohammed Issa, you remember the black hole of Calcutta? Well, no, but you also, I don't know whether you were taught, you're younger than I am, aren't you? Yeah, exactly. I was taught it. So it was a part of our curriculum. The black hole of Calcutta, well, no, you tell them. I mean, the black hole of Calcutta was a monstrous thing that was done to a group of British in India during the period of, it's the 100 years before that. It was during the period of when Clive was conquering Bengal. Anyway, so we were discovering India. We were discovering the indigenous people of the Americas, which we call Red Indians. Amazing stories. We came across a very important book, Black Elk Speaks, this great medicine man. And the way he talked about the natural world was incredible. And of course, you've also got to remember that 1960s was the time when we were discovering the fact that there was an environmental crisis. It was the period when Rachel Carter came out with her amazing book, The Silent Spring, when she warned against the whole business of the chemicals going onto the fields. And so it was an incredible period, the 60s. It was a real period of discovery. But, you know, the problem with the modern mind, with the Western mind, is that the reactions to the horrors, for example, Marxism. Marxism is a brilliant analysis of capitalism. Capitalism requires to be analyzed because it's a horror. But Marxism's solution is just as bad. It's just as bad because it's a part of the same world. It's the same environment. It's the same structure. And it was what happened in a sense at the end of the 60s was a complete rejection of all of that. We have to create a world of love, of peace. It was going back to Christ in a way, without him. You know, the old instead, getting into these states of, you know, and then the music. Huge, you know, music and the Maharishis coming from India, you know, sitting there with these huge millions of people, you know, going into a state of heightened ecstasy with this bum, you know, this incredible, strange world. So much of it was just coming out of empire, because we're living in the post-colonial world. We're living in a world that where the whole colonization of the world, which started 500 years ago, is still taking place. That's the world we're living in. And we're coming to the end of it, because the whole cycle is coming to a completion. So one lived through all of this, but the 60s were very important. It was very important. But the most powerful aspect of the 50s is that many people came out of the 60s and went into Islam. Many people. But the main drift of it was to produce this insane modern world that we now inhabit. It's to replace Christianity in terms of morality and to replace civilization in terms of ethics. That is what has come out of the 60s. And that is what we are now having to face, which is a complete breakdown of society.
In your book, you talk about Ustad Mahmud Mirza.
Yeah.
Can you explain the impact this man had on you?
Well, it was the greatest impact that any human beings had upon me. And it's an impact which continues, because he came from India. And of course, we saw India as Hindu in those times. We didn't know about Muslim India. And he arrived in London for a concert tour. And we met, and for some extraordinary reason, I was by that time with my wife, and she was a musical one. And we met him, and he simply introduced us to a completely different world. A world of order, of beauty, and of a kind of ecstasy that we were seeking, but a kind of completeness, completion. He introduced us to a traditional art form, the music of the courts of Mughal India, the high classical music of Muslim India, the music which is the equivalent of the architecture of the Taj Mahal or of the great mosques of India. This is the music that goes back 700 years to Amir Khusro, the great poet, courtier, and musician. The music that took everything from everywhere and put it together in the way that Islam always does, and is Indian, but is out of the pure Islamic spirit. A music of musicians who would wrestle in the morning to keep themselves fit, and who were like, the power in them was incredible. And the stillness and the humility and the way in which they were so different, because my background was in the arts, in modern art, which is all to do with the expression of the ego of the artist. Suddenly you were faced with a master who had no ego. When he sat in front of you and he played, there was no ego. And it could reach levels, sublime levels. And of course, he began his music training from his uncle when he was 5 years old. And he went right through and he became a master. And by the time we met him, he was a master. He'd mastered it. He'd mastered it in terms of the craft. But most important of all, the first thing they learn, which is the last thing the modern learns, if they do learn it, is humility. That is what they learn, so that they can become the perfect vehicles for the art to pass through them, for the inspiration. And I once asked him, I said to him, what do you fear most? He said, I fear most my inspiration being cut off. No claim. So this man, who to all outward purposes is a completely ordinary man, apart from music, he's just a human being, very quiet. But for me, it was like the first piece of that puzzle, that piece which is an authentic piece of that glorious world of Islam. And then all the other pieces started to come into place. So that was my entry. That was what Almighty Allah gave me as my entry into Islam. If he'd given me a sheikh of religion, a sheikh of a Sufi sheikh, I would have just gone off. But because he gave me a musician, music, something which is very controversial, an Indian Muslim musician in India where the Muslims were being destroyed. He gave me something which couldn't become big in itself, but he gave me something which led me to want to explore and understand the world of Islam. So this is where it came. And the next really important thing that happened was that he came from Delhi. He was from the heart of Muslim India. In my gallery had been engaged with kinetic art, and many of the artists were Iberian or South Americans, but from South America, and they were very interested in patterns. So they were they loved the Alhambra, they loved Moorish Spain and the geometric patterns. So I knew something about Moorish Spain. I was looking and seeing, gosh, this is Delhi, these architects, it's the same world. It's the same world. And that's where the idea of the World of Islam Festival came, because the only thing that connected Moorish Spain and Mughal India was Islam. Nothing else that that connected them. Then the languages are different, the pre-cultures are different, everything was different, the races were different. So this is where the idea for the world of Islam came. And it was again, I always say this about converts, is that when you become a convert, and it took me 7 years before I actually embraced Islam. I was just wallowing in the joy of the arts and the beauty of the civilization and organizing this festival. But the thing which is incredible is that the clarity of the unity of Islam comes through the arts. You cannot look for any length of time, from West Africa through to China. China, we can now see, it is one world. The arts, it's the same aesthetic, it's the same hierarchy of arts. It's the calligraphy and then the geometric pattern and all the rest of it. The same world, the same incredible mizan, the balance. That is what comes through in terms of the arts. And of course, that's what led in the end. Because what happened basically is I had a very clear picture of the world of Islam in terms of the arts. And then what's happened over the last 60 years is a gradually filling in of all the other dimensions, realizing that it relates to every aspect of Islam, to the social, to the legal, to the rulership, to the merchant, to every dimension of Islam, creating this incredible world of Islam, Dar al-Islam, which of course is no more, was destroyed, along with all the other worlds, by the huge eruption that took place out of Europe 500 years ago.
Can I ask you about the festival, the World of Islam Festival, which you organize? Just talk me through the festival, the scale of it, how it was received. Because I've noticed you've talked about this festival on a number of occasions when we've met, maybe every occasion we've met, but I've never really explored the content, the detail of the exhibition. Just talk me through that, please.
Yeah, well, I was in a corner because there was a first festival in 1971. And for reasons I won't go into, because I want people to buy the book and read it in the book, I came out of that festival in a hole because there was £10,000 owing after all the bills were paid. And I had become personally responsible for it. And this is, again, one of these things which I don't think there would have ever been a second festival if that festival had succeeded financially. Because what happened was I went to Switzerland to attend my brother's wedding. This was at the beginning of 1972. And I was in really a pickle because I went a week earlier, and I went up and stayed in this little chalet hotel in the mountains. And it's not something I usually do. I'm not very mystical. I don't usually do this kind of thing. But then I was really faced with a problem. And I had to have a conversation because I was on the verge of going bankrupt. And in those days, by the way, it was quite a serious business. It wasn't funny. It wasn't a business business opportunity, which is now how it's been understood. And I asked myself the question, was the World of Islam Festival a good idea? And the answer that came back was, yes, but it's got to be done at the top level. I said, right, okay. What do you mean by this? The answer that came back was this. The World of Islam Festival, it is such a huge subject. It's got to involve all the major museums. It's got to involve all the academic world in terms of lectures and seminars. It's got to have a great performing arts program. It's got to have books. It's got to have a television series. And it's got to be opened by Her Majesty the Queen. And I answered, is that it? And the answer that came back was yes, because that's the only way you're going to get out of the hole. Because then the 10,000 is just a part of the preparations for this big event. So I came back to London in February 1972, and I went straight to the Arts Council, the Arts Council of Great Britain then, straight to the exhibitions director, because that was the place where you could do a big show. And I put forward the idea of a great exhibition, which would be the center of a festival in which all the different aspects would be discovered, would be studied. And the Arts Council at the Hayward Gallery, which is their major exhibition venue, would put on the exhibition of the Arts of Islam. Now, I'm not going to go through, because it's a long story, what happened, because I had a whole year in which to keep everything going, keep my £10,000 debt at bay, and somehow, you know, get the thing going. because I got a very good response from the Arts Council of Great Britain Exhibitions Committee, but they had a problem; they weren't able to introduce it for a year. So I then went to all the other institutions. I went to the Science Museum and said, "Could we have a science exhibition? If the Arts Council agree, would you put on an exhibition of Islamic science?" And I went to the British Library. Would you put on an exhibition of the Holy Quran? And then I went to the Museum of Mankind. Will you do an exhibition of Nomad and City? And so on and so forth. So by the end of the year, there were 12 major exhibitions in London. All the major museums had been engaged. And that had never happened before, and it's never happened since. Meanwhile, I went to SIRS, and I went to the only failure I had was the BBC, because they had had their great Civilization series, which had been a huge success, and they wanted to follow it with another blockbuster 12-part series. So I went and talked to them about the world of Islam, and the Arts Council were considering it, would they be interested? And it went through lots of committees and the rest of it. But finally, it was turned down. Do you know why it's turned down? They said there simply won't be enough interest. No, nobody knows anything about the world of Islam. What is the world of Islam? Because you see, in those days, the concept of the world of Islam didn't exist. It was the Arabs, the Persians, India was Hindu, the Malay world. And the Malays were these characters who went around with axes, going amok. It was unbelievable. I mean, the world of Islam was completely fragmented and was seen as a religion. It was not understood as a civilization. So what, to put a short thing on this, it actually happened, and all those projects took place. The books were published, the film series actually did take place, because the BBC came back 2 years later, when of course the oil price suddenly went up, and suddenly there was all the money in the world to do the project. It's quite incredible. That was 1973, the end of October. So it's an incredible story. And again, it's one of those stories where you look at it and you think to yourself, well, this is an impossibility. But then extraordinary things happen. Amazing things take place. And somebody once there were a group of academics once sitting down, and they were saying, we were trying to work out this man, Paul Keeler, because he'd come out of nowhere, They said, what's his talent? And they said, I know, it's timing. He has an extraordinary sense of time. And this made me laugh. No timing. I had no sense of timing whatsoever. I just went where my heart took me. And my wife is a complete, I don't know where she is. She outside. Oh, you're there. she will stand for this, because I have no sense of timing. I just literally follow my heart. Is that enough on the festival?
I mean, that's fantastic.
I really want them to read the book.
No, I appreciate that. Your journey takes you. You describe your journey to be a journey into Islam, and as you embrace the faith and as you develop an intimate understanding of Islam, you develop an idea, which I think your book, which is the central theme of your book, the Mizan idea, the Mizan thesis. And at the very beginning of today's session, you described how this is not an autobiography in a sense. It's really a book that formulates how you came to a set of concepts about Islam. Can you take us through that conceptual journey, please?
Well, I think what was really important was that from the very outset, I realized we were dealing with a completely different world from the one that I knew or I'd been brought up in. It was a totally different world. And that was then completely sort of reinforced by the realization of the unity of the world of Islam in terms of the arts. That was the basis of the thing. And from then on, it was just seeing like light coming onto different aspects. It took me a very long time to comprehend the Sharia. And I have to say that, again, these are one of the things, it was very late. It was when I was actually working on the book, before I started writing, but when I was working on the research for it. And it was a lecture I went to, and then a book that I read. Being an academic book, I had to read it about three or four times with dictionaries and, getting through jungle world of insanity in terms of getting the gold out of it, But it was a book by Wael Hallaq called The Impossible State. And that book reveal to me the beauty of the Sharia. The fact that this is a system, this completely all-encompassing system of how you conduct your life. It's amazing. And he did that. He was able to put that across. And he put it across. And he showed how the thing grew into this vast structure. That was, you know, so with all these different aspects, it was like when I met one of the merchants, the great merchant families of Syria, and became very close to this wonderful scholar and merchant. And he illuminated my mind as to the pious merchant in Islam and how that merchant could carry Islam to the Malay world, to China, to the South India, to all across the world, into the West Africa and deep into Africa. And he, particularly, his family used to have a shop in the olden times in the street named Strait, where St. Paul went to recover his sight from Ananias. And it was when I went for the first time to Damascus in 1973, I went straight to the street named Strait because I'm Paul. And I knew all about it. And it was amazing because that street, the Jewish community, which has been the same place it had been in at the time when St. Paul went there 2,000 years ago, that community of the Jews had been there until the State of Israel was formed. It was still warm, the same, that was where they were. And he told me how all the different communities would trade in that street. And wonderful stories, and some of them are in the book. But it was so my illumination has come through the meeting of extraordinary people. I mean, during the festival, one of the great illuminations for me was with Sayyid Hussein Nasr, because he'd done all this work on the sciences of Islam. And he showed how the whole mind concept of the Muslim scholar dealing with the material world was completely different from that of the modern. And how the way they viewed astronomy, the way they viewed, you know, alchemy, the way they viewed all the different sciences, the material realm, they were dealing with a sacred world. And then this takes you to this wonderful understanding within Islam, which is the understanding that there are two revelations. There's a revelation of the Holy Quran, and there's a revelation of the creation. The creation is revelation. That is why the Prophet could talk to mountains, could understand the pebbles, could understand all of existence. And this is where the horrors of modernity have come about, because within Christendom you always had this separation between the sacred and the secular. There is no such separation within Islam. Traditionally, Darul Islam was a sacred world. And if you behaved badly in it, you were doing something very nasty, very bad. You were disrupting the Mizan. But that world was so magnificently structured because it was the manifestation of the revelation of the Holy Quran. The whole world of Islam, the whole of Darazan was a manifestation of that. It was completely connected into the natural, into the creation and into the hereafter. And in that world, it was impossible to do a bad act without that bad act being recognized and being against the Mizan. So then suddenly you discover this is where the whole final sort of the final result, what resulted in this was that Islam and the West, a new narrative for the age of crisis. And the new narrative is the narrative of Mizan. Because Mizan is a fundamental principle which provides all of existence with its framework. If things are out of balance, they very rapidly go into chaos and they descend. Mizan is not just balance, it's justice, it's scale. Look at the breaking of scale that took place with the Industrial Revolution. Suddenly the human being had very, very long arms, huge legs, went into it's much better than mine. Everybody's complaining about my son. Mizan for me was a huge breakthrough, because it also explains why the West has become what it has become. And it also made me understand the fundamental principle of this book, which is the concept of the three worlds. how the three powers within human civilization are the power of the scholar, the power of the mind, the power of the warrior, of rulers, and the power of the merchant. And what happened in the West was that, first of all, we had the power of the scholar, the priest, and Christianity produced for 1,000 years in the West, it produced in Western Europe a Christian world. But that Christian world was very vertically oriented. It had very little of the horizontal. And then there was a complete change with the Renaissance, when the world that had been dead and buried for 1,000 years was suddenly dug up and glorified. And you got the period of civilization, you get the idea of civilization, you get the humanities, you get the focus on the human. And this is the period of the stage of civilization. Suddenly the warrior becomes the pinnacle. The saint is replaced by the warrior. All the statues become the statues of warriors on horseback. The last of the great warriors, of course, was Winston Churchill on his plinth in Westminster Square. And then you get the merchant coming through. And then you come through and you have the merchant, the age of the merchant, where the power lies with the merchant, the material world. And he only understands the material world if he is separated from the spiritual dimension. And all capitalism is, all it is the way that the merchants will behave if they have absolutely no sanction upon them, if there is no spiritual sanction upon them, if they are not limited. That's how they will behave. They will simply reduce everything to coinage, to money. And so this is where we had these three worlds. And this is where, for me, the great enlightenment came, when I realized that in Islam, all these three worlds were contained within the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He was the great teacher. He lived in a merchant community and practiced trade. And he was a warrior and leader par excellence. So for Islam, all these powers were all focused upon the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. They took their ordering from him. And this is the fundamental basis of this book, of the concept of Mizan.
Thank you very much. We have around 10 minutes for audience participation. Can I ask you to keep your questions short? We've got a roving mic as well. So I invite you to ask your questions, please. We've got a question here up front.
My question is, this concept of Mizan, it's a beautiful idea. How has it been received by wider non-Muslim audiences? And the second part to this question is, man as the microcosm to the macrocosm, man in his journey, my understanding is that it's the later arc of his life where he attains a state of balance. What about the civilization? When do you think this balance might come about in our kind of trajectory and where we're going as a civilization?
First question, what was that? Because
that was the first question was this idea of Mizan and balance. Yeah. How has it been received by wider non-Muslim audiences?
Very interesting question. I spend most of my time with Muslims, because in order to understand the Mizan, it's easy with the Muslims, because the Muslim religion is intact. And the Muslim religion is Mizan. It's all about Mizan. It's all about balance. This is the beauty of it, the balancing of our lives. And we are being taught that by our teachers all the time. That's what our sheikhs are teaching us. That's what everybody's teaching who is engaged with Islam. It's fundamental. The problem with the Muslims is that the mindset of seeing the world is modern. The Muslims are a conquered people, as all traditional people have been conquered, including our own. So the concept, the narrative, if you like, that commands the world today is a narrative of progress, because it's the only narrative that pure materialism can have. It has to promise you a better world. It has to say things are improving. It has to basically say, take what belongs to heaven onto earth and say, we are going to create paradise on earth. Of course, it's nonsense. And this takes me to the other very important thing about this book, is the whole concept of the age of crises. Because when this idea of progress was put together by a lot of different thinkers like Hegel and Marx and oh goodness knows who, all these characters in the 19th century. They put it together at a time when it appeared that this new modern thing was sensational. The downsides hadn't yet appeared. They thought the power that they had, the fact that the things they could do with their long arms and their long legs, incredible. I'm very impressed. And they were conquering the world. How could you explain this? Obviously, you know, humanity was progressing because they were at the top of the sea. All these other people were barbarians and were savages and everything. And they were bringing civilization, and they were bringing progress. And this concept of progress continues, because it's the only thing that powers modernity. You remove progress, and there is no point to it. However, we're now living in the age of crisis, because the minute the overactive scientific mind discovered, as Einstein realized to his great misery, the atom bomb, they crossed the threshold where humanity could destroy. I reside in Cambridge, where over the last 70 years, any number of ways have been devised for our destruction. Chemical warfare, biological warfare, crazy things that are going on in technology, AI, which is now getting out of control. It's incredible. And most important of all those atomic explosions of the 60s in terms of morality and ethics are now instilled within the society. So we're living in the age of crisis, and modernity cannot deliver the world the paradise that it promises. And that's why people do not believe it anymore. The young people are not having children. They know, they can see, because when you're young, you are born with fresh eyes. The young people that I'm seeing coming into Cambridge, these young Muslims are wonderful. They're alive, they're morally intact, they are incredible. They give you, they realize that Almighty Allah has a wonderful way of dealing with things. And this comes to me, one of the things which I always like to talk about, and that is the beautiful generation of Muslims that's growing up. What a heroes, what amazing people those grandparents were. The ones who arrived in England in the 50s and the 60s. Enoch Powell, all the prejudices. And these people, they came and look what they did. They created mosques, they created halal butchers, they created all the infrastructure that a way of life could be lived. And I have been informed by so many of these grandfathers, people who come from villages, but whose Islam was very powerful, whose Islam was beautiful. And they've taught me so much. I have so many friends amongst them. And in Cambridge, there's such beautiful people of that generation. And so beautiful things are happening. Islam is an amazing story, and it's his story, not ours. We are simply actors. We are given our parts, but his is the plan, and it's a beautiful plan, even though we are now living in the darkest of time, because for the Muslims, we have our religion, we have the refuge, and we are the witness, the truth, at a time when everywhere around us is a storm of insanity and untruth, like the time of Mecca.
Thank you very much. I think we'll take a selection of questions because we are running out of time. So can I take it from the sister here first, please?
Assalamu alaikum. Is this on?
We can hear you.
Yeah, assalamu alaikum. Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much. It was very enlightening. My question kind of leads on from the brother's question. It's just, as you see this crisis and this dismantling of modernity, what is your projection? What's your projection for this crisis in terms of the timescale, and what would it look like, and also the vacuum it would leave, what would that look like? And do you then think that it's the responsibility of this generation of Muslims to fill in that vacuum?
Can I answer that question?
Oh, please, you can.
When you do multiple things, I've always forgotten the ones. This is a beautiful question. I have absolutely no idea. The one thing I have learned is never to look into the future. You have to look at the past. You have to look at the past and understand the past. But in terms of the future, that's his business. This is one of the criminal parts of modernity, is the idea of attempting to control the future. Your risk assessment, all this. It's amazing. I've been in Cambridge now for 32 years. When I arrived in Cambridge, it was a civilized university. In other words, Latin and Greek were at the center. and the professors were the kings. Then, over the period of time, modernity has taken over. Now business studies and science is at the center. You have to create something new, and you have to be able to sell it. Entrepreneurship and innovation are all that are prized within the university. And the modern corporate administration has taken over. In the what was the Oriental Faculty, which is now the Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, when we arrived there, there were 2.5 people in the administration, mother, a daughter, and half Northumbrian. Now the administration is about 20 people, risk assessments, this assessment, that assessment, and the poor scholars, the academics, are having to fill in forms the whole time, are burdened with administration. Why? Because the corporate world has no trust. Trusts in nothing. It has to control everything, has to control the future. So we've moved into this thing. But in terms of the future, there may be sheikhs who can tell you, I'm of a very lowly grade. If you knew how low my grade was, you wouldn't even want to come to my meeting.
We're out of time now. Thank you very much for your attendance today. We were looking at the book, A Life's Journey, The Story Behind a Book. I think this book is available on the stall outside, inshallah. So, Jazakallah Khair, I really much valued that conversation. It was fantastic. Wonderful to see you once again, Sheikh Ahmed. And we plan to do another show soon, I believe. I think so. It's due. So, Jazakallah Khair. Thank you very much for all your time today. And thank you to Sheikh Ahmed.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival programme is now live. Visit bradfordlitfest.co.uk to discover the huge range of events on offer over 10 days from the 27th of June. Don't miss out. Book your tickets now.